Good evening and welcome to Radio EduTalk. My name is David Noble, over in Dalgety Bay as ever, and absolutely delighted this evening to be joined on Professional Learning for Teachers channel by Professor Donald Gillis, who is the new head of the School of Education at the University of the West of Scotland. And over the next half hour or so, we're just going to be hearing from Professor Gillis on the differences between current educational policies in England and Scotland. As ever, you can interact with the live show in two ways. You can email over the next half an hour edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, you can pop something up using the hashtag edutalk, and I'll look out for any comments or questions that you would like to put to Professor Gillis. One other resource to mention is that if you go to the edutalk.cc website at the moment, if you're listening to the live stream, and in the blue bar near the top it says click here for key links, and if you click on that link you will be able to get access to some questions that Donald has posed this evening, and also some links to some key texts around this evening's topic. So welcome to the show, Donald. I understand you've just recently made a move back up from a university in York.
That's correct. Just coming to the end of my 3 months at University of the West of Scotland, having been at York St John University.
Okay, and I think you're just going to start off by just kind of talking around the topic briefly, and then it would be great if listeners would like to come in with, as I say, some questions or comments. I've got plenty of my own, but it would be great to. I know that on Twitter over the last few days there's been quite a level of interest, and I'm sure we'll get some live listeners tonight, and hopefully some questions. So if you want to maybe just start by setting the scene, that would be great.
Right, thanks very much, David. As you mentioned, I spent a couple of years down in England, having prior to that been at the University of Strathclyde, so able to get a reasonable picture of both systems, which had been my professional interest anyway. So tonight I want to speak a little about the differences between the two systems currently. Given the effects of increasing globalisation, the worldwide reach of neoliberal ideas, and the growing role of key supranational bodies such as the OECD, it should not be surprising that state education systems have been subject to some convergence in recent years. Of course, within the Western tradition, there always was considerable similarity, with almost all educational provision looking back to Plato for its source. That said, it would not be an exaggeration, I feel, to argue that the Scottish and English systems, certainly as far as school education is concerned, are about as different as any two could be within the confines that have already been outlined. Of course, the two systems have remained separate over the centuries, the education system of Scotland being preserved as distinct, along with its legal and religious institutions, within the terms of the 1707 Act of Union. However, there's no doubt that divergence is currently at its most stark, a bifurcation that has been in place since well before the devolution settlement of 1997. These different paths can be partly ascribed to political differences, partly to cultural tradition, and partly to systemic features. Scottish politics is often said to be marked by more communal than individualistic values, which is often said to account for the relatively low popularity of the Conservative Party in Scotland. And this political difference is said to be at the root of the educational divergence we witness currently. It's always hard to substantiate such a claim, and many point to the fact that the Conservative Party of 1955 was the last party in Scotland to have achieved an overall majority in the Scottish popular vote at a Westminster election. What is a factor, however, in the political equation is the way in which tactical voting in Scotland has become embedded to the extent that the voting pattern has become inimical to Conservative Party fortunes in a very marked and rooted way. Tactical voting really took off as a considered and concerted attempt by the opposition parties to respond to the impact of Thatcherite policies in Scotland in the 1980s. The result has been that across much of Scotland, voters have favoured the party locally, most likely to defeat the Tories. Once a tactical vote for a specific time, it has become the traditional vote now in many areas. It may not be very deep, however. Professor John Curtis at the weekend was pointing out that in the northeast of Scotland, which is hugely supportive of the SNP electorally, translating that into yes votes for independence has proved to be a challenge. Voting for the SNP in parliamentary elections may well be for many voters simply the best guarantee in their constituency of keeping the Tories out. Despite this acknowledgement, however, it has to be accepted that for at least a generation, support for the Tories has been falling and has now bottomed out at less than 20% across Scotland, even at a time when the Tories were winning at Westminster. There is a political divide, however fragilely structured, which has meant that Tory policies in education have neither been followed in Scotland nor have they been influential. New Labour had to respond to the Tory hold in England, and there are those who feel that they did that by co-opting many Tory policy stances. In Scotland, that simply did not have to be done. The weakness of the Tory vote in Scotland has meant there has been no need for the other parties to respond to Tory policy positions, and certainly not to ape them. The general political thrust in England has been an odd mix of the neoconservative and the neoliberal. For the education system, this has meant a neoconservative approach to curriculum and schooling generally, but with a neoliberal approach to governance. Thus, we have a mandated curriculum set out for schools in line with very traditional views of what knowledge is and what ought to be learned, and a similar neoconservative insistence on standards, traditional exams, and academic focus. At the same time, there has been a move to a more neoliberal framework, marked by such things as parental choice over schooling, creation of quasi-markets, specialist schools, more powers to schools away from local authorities, the academy programme, and the free schools movement. Nowhere is this paradox of the neoconservative and the neoliberal more evident than in the absolute, supposedly principled insistence on a set national curriculum for state schools, while at the same time allowing academies and free schools exemption from that prescription. Almost none of the above has happened in Scotland, and nor has there been any evident demand for it. There are a handful of specialist schools, dance, music, but these remain within local authority control. Calls in Scotland for more diversity in schools have only come from the Tory party, really, and from some libertarian groups such as Reform Scotland. While more than half of England's secondary schools are either academies or free schools, 96% of Scotland's school pupils remain in local authority schools. Less than 4% are in private schools, compared to 7% in England. At the same time in England, a very draconian and punitive inspection system has developed, with even some of this subcontracted to private firms, some of whose inspection teams are not led by anyone with educational experience. Meanwhile, through Teach First and School Direct, the role of teacher education institutions and the universities has been reduced, with much more of initial teacher education being school-led and school-based. In Scotland, inspection has been increasingly focused on self-evaluation by schools and local authorities, and the merging of the inspectorate with the curriculum development organisation has further served to place the inspectorate in a developmental supportive role rather than that of judge and jury. Teacher education remains entirely within the university system in Scotland, with partnerships with local authorities being encouraged, limited inspectorate involvement, a central role for the General Teaching Council, and strategic political control of recruitment numbers. None of this remains in England. The growing reduction of state support or control in England and the move from the communal to the individualistic is highlighted in the introduction of tuition fees for university students. Students are now charged up to £9,000 per annum, while in Scotland no such fees are charged for its students. Thus, overall, we can picture a continuance of a state system in Scotland with emphasis on partnership and collective approaches as opposed to a much more diverse, varied and indeed fractured position in England. But then cohesion in Scotland's system is much easier to achieve given its size. There are more teacher education providers in Yorkshire, where I worked, than there are in the whole of Scotland. The political ethos of Scottish education is more marked by consensus and caution, the English one more strident and contested and undoubtedly more ideological. However, for all that, what can we say? The curricula, with their subjects, curricular areas, four key stages or levels, are not so widely different between the two countries. One may be a national curriculum and the other curriculum guidelines, but the effects are not so dissimilar. For all the upheaval in England in terms of governance and structures, the recent PISA results show no major differences in outcomes compared to Scotland. Lack of tuition fees have not made Scotland's universities more socially mixed, and its commitment to comprehensive education and local authority schools has not resulted in better outcomes for the poor, nor reduced the attainment gap. The pupil premium in England demonstrates a considerable commitment to addressing that gap, a commitment not matched, financially at least, in Scotland. Time will tell if that bold initiative bears fruit. The systems were always separate, and devolution made further divergence possible. Politically managed, they are open to electoral change. Their respective populations can always achieve that, although no longer so in England at local authority level. But in neither case is there much sign of any radical change from what is already there. They are different. Deal with it, as they say.
Donald, that's fantastic. You know, thank you so much for the fantastic input. And just give people a couple of moments to kind of digest key points there. And as I say, if you want to come in with a comment or question for Professor Gillis, then you can get in touch in two ways. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk. That's edutalkr. Or if you're on Twitter, just include the hashtag edutalk. Thanks again. One of the links that you sent through, and as I say, they're available at edutalk.cc, was to a symposium at King's College in London. And I was interested, it was a critical discourse analysis on speeches made by Michael Gove over the last few years. Maybe you could say a wee bit about, for the benefit of listeners, what critical discourse analysis is, and then maybe pick out what your conclusions were. I mean, for me, the one thing that jumped out was that it doesn't seem to be too bothered about what's going on in Scotland, whereas I'm often struck going to national conferences about how soon into many speakers' keynotes that they start to talk about how, thank goodness, we're not doing things the way that Michael Gove's doing in England.
Yep. Critical discourse analysis is an approach really to analysing text-based sources. It's a way of exploring text for, you know, it can be done on a number of different levels. When it's critical discourse analysis, it's really concerned with looking at the assumptions, perhaps some of the concepts there, looking for any contradictions, any telling ideological links and so on. It's quite a complicated approach, but it can be done in a number of ways. So I was partly motivated because, having moved to England, I thought I'd been used to using this form of research method, but I thought it'd be a good way of getting up to speed with Michael Gove was, what his position was. So it was partly sort of professional development as well as research. He's an extremely complicated individual, complex person, and he is often stereotyped and caricatured, but he's a much more complicated individual than that. I think a couple of the points which I made was that, you know, an extraordinary amount of his speeches are dedicated to issues of social disadvantage and the attainment gap. And people might be quite surprised at how much for a conservative politician, how concerned he is with the disadvantaged. The strange thing is that his approaches to that are almost entirely to do with the structure of education systems and the sort of link to wider socio-economic issues and problems is not really engaged with. It all tends to be within school issues about structures, about attitudes. An awful lot of the attainment gap is attributed by Michael Gove to low aspirations and poor expectations of teachers, which I think is really, you know, a marginal issue, really, when you're looking at the scale of the structural problems across society. He has, over time, I think, become more ideological. I think at the start he was much more a kind of driven person to make positive change. Has tended to become more ideological, more critical of the profession and of opponents. And so I think he's kind of almost backed himself into a corner in some areas and not really managed to take people with him that would have helped to make his policies more popular across the profession and across the country. But having said that, you know, many of his initiatives on academies and free schools, you know, Tristram Hunt, his Labour opponent, has said that Labour will not unravel those in the new, should Labour be elected. So although he is being positioned as a person very much on the right of the Tory party, in actual fact, Labour has not positioned itself or guaranteed that it's going to unravel much of his reforms. I was just going to say, on your final point about Scotland, he makes very little reference to Scotland whatsoever, although many people in the press try to attribute his outlook to his Scottish upbringing and his own personal circumstances, but he himself makes very little reference to Scotland. He's much more interested in a kind of worldwide issue. He wants the English system to be world class and up with the best internationally. So he's got a much wider horizons than his own background.
And moving to kind of education policy across the two countries in general, it seems to be from reading a couple of your papers and your chapter in the book Scottish Education that autonomy is a real feature of discourse and of, you know, including policy documents, but the autonomy that's talked about in Scotland is very different from that talked about in England.
Yeah, I think there has been in both countries, and it's an international, a global issue about leadership. I mean, across the public sector, but particularly in education, and we already have it in Scotland with the kind of virtual college that has been set up by government and is currently, you know, being developed. So leadership is a key theme in both settings. In England, however, it's been linked to this sense of autonomy in the academies programme, the free schools movement, to break the link with local authorities and to give schools their own initiative and their own autonomy. But because of the inspection regime and all these other features of the English system, you know, it's very much autonomy within a very tightly controlled structure. So I'm not saying it's playing with words, but, you know, it has to be understood. The idea of autonomy, of self-rule, doesn't really apply. There are some, certainly, powers for head teachers in England, which they didn't used to have in the academy programme, but it's not, you couldn't really see it was freedom. In Scotland, again, I don't think that discourse is quite so strong. It has been more about, you know, there's much more positive views of local authority involvement in education generally. And although, you know, I think there could be a case for revision, we have, is it 31, if you include the island councils, you know, that's really a huge number of different authorities for a very small country. And I think there must be issues there about economies of scale and of partnership which could be developed.
When you're talking about economies of scale there, Donald, it brought to mind, I think your chapter in Scottish Education where you talk about the business managers who are running schools in England and how we haven't got to that stage in Scotland, and yet you mention that we have chief executives or heads of service of shared services across more than one council, and that might be a different route to having non-education specialists actually running the show.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. I mean, there are cases in England where, you know, heads have come in from non-educational backgrounds. We have these academy chains as well. You know, a major one, the one run by Lord Harris, formerly of, he was a carpet manufacturer of some type. So he came in from outside education. And as I mentioned in my talk there, some of the tribal, for example, one of the inspection groups in England quite often has teams who are not led by an educationist. The example I gave in Scotland was, and I think this is a positive thing in one sense, having, you know, and everyone has been pushing for integrated children's services, getting it right for every child and trying to make sure that all of those are integrated. The effect can be, however, I think in local authorities, you could get someone in charge of schooling who's come perhaps from a different background, maybe health or social work. So that can be there to a certain extent. Whether or not that is, you know, significant, you know, I couldn't really say. I don't think we've got any evidence to say one way or the other.
We've got a question from Katrina Oates, who's listening in this evening. She's saying, change seems to happen fast in England, but slowly here. Do you think that the consensus-driven approach in Scotland slows things down?
I think that's a good question, and one that has been raised, you know, that maybe the consensus is a bit too cosy, maybe it's too cautious, too conservative, we don't seem to move very much. I think there has been a strong feeling from government over, you know, even prior to the SNP-led regimes, that, you know, consensus was the way forward. I think Jack McConnell tried hard to do that after the Macron report, to bring people together, and that is still, I think, very much the situation. The unions, the GTC, government, local authorities, tending to try and create consensus and partnership. So it's positive in terms of stability. It does mean that perhaps change happens very slowly. In England, I think there is a feeling of the exact opposite, the opposite extreme, really. You know, a change happening so often. You know, I used to say, you know, I'd wake up when I was living in York, and there was a new initiative almost every morning from Michael Gove and someone. It was very difficult for people on the ground in schools to, you know, to keep up with this sort of constant initiative. And also the tone is very much one of a kind of crisis, a permanent crisis, and you know, it's kind of fed by the media as well. So, you know, I was very glad I didn't work in schools in England. I think it must be an extremely stressful and a debilitating experience.
And you talk about binaries that exist in the English education system. I'm just wondering, and because you've been in York, but you've spent a large part of your career obviously working within Scottish education. Do binaries exist within Scottish educational discourse? And also, do you feel there's an existence of what I think you termed an elitist discourse, which, as you've kind of alluded to, is very prevalent in England? Does that exist, that kind of best practice, or exist in other forms in Scotland?
I didn't. It was a feature, I felt, of Michael Gove's speeches and articles over the 3-year period I was exploring, that was very much of those binaries: good, bad, successful, unsuccessful, poor. You know, and it's that kind of language that is used by the inspectorate in England, by Ofsted, failing schools. I don't think that kind of very emotive language is common in Scotland. Now, whether or not that is just people being more diplomatic, or whether or not we don't have anything that would give rise to that kind of language, you know, I wouldn't like to say, but I do think the English discourse around education, and certainly coming from Michael Gove and from government, has tended to be very much of that critical, very sharp, critical binaries. There are things that work and things that don't work, and there's no kind of grey areas. Everything's very crystal clear. And the elitist discourse was again about, you know, this sort of language of the brightest and the best, which I always think is very, you know, very dubious. And it's also, it assumes, as I've often argued, if you're talking about the brightest and the best, you're assuming there must be some other group with the dullest and worst, which, you know, is certainly not the way I would like the students that I teach to look upon education and upon the youngsters that are in their charge, you know. I would like to think people were a bit more positive about what they were doing.
And just returning, just maybe for one final time to the way that Michael Gove appears to operate, I'm just wondering if there's an argument that his messages are maybe quite seductive. You know, the idea that it's all about what goes on in the classroom, it's all about the quality of teaching and learning and the robustness of the curriculum, and I just wonder if he's saying to teachers explicitly in a roundabout way, you know, it's not your business to worry about macroeconomic issues such as endemic poverty. You know, you're not going to use that as an excuse. It's all about, it's all down to how you do your job.
Yeah, I think it's seductive for the general public or parts of the general public that might be attracted by that. I think, you know, most teachers are honest with themselves, would see that their capacity to influence is, you know, relatively limited compared to the baggage that children bring into school. That doesn't mean you give up, or it doesn't mean that you have low expectations, but it does mean that you're realistic about the impact that you can have as an individual or schools can have as a group. I think one of the positive things I would say that is in the English system is this very, very strong commitment to improvement. You know, it's a very, very strident issue there. How it's gone about, I think, is very unsettling for many people in the teaching profession. But there's no doubt there is an extremely strong commitment to a sense of improvement and that things could be better. I don't hear such a thing in Scotland. Although, as I said in my piece, you know, in actual fact, when you look at the two systems, advantage pupils in both systems are outstripping others by considerable distances, regardless of how the two systems are structured. We don't seem to be able to crack that particular problem.
And you mentioned about how PISA scores in general are fairly similar. So, in terms of PISA scores in general and in terms of solving the problem of underachievement, are you involved or are you aware of research that's looking into this? I mean, it seems to me that this isn't really recognised or being paid attention to widely.
I think there are certain things that were achieved in England in the London Challenge, for example, which were quite remarkable, which did narrow the attainment gap considerably, and there are still parts of London years after the Young London Challenge that have helped to sustain that. I think Tower Hamlets is one area where it has been successful. But the London Challenge and others like that was actually not so much based on these targets for improvement. It was all about schools working together and learning from each other. So it was very much a sort of collective approach across council areas, very much posited on professional development and so on. And that's not something that can be promoted so much now when you have academies and free schools and there's a much more splintered approach. But I think if you look at across the globe, countries where the attainment gap is not so marked, you just have to look at the child poverty figures to you know, there's a very, very close correlation. If your society has got the big gaps that we have in our society in terms of social mobility from generation to generation, we've got very, very fixed gaps that don't seem to shift over time. And then across the North Sea, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, you know, you've got well under 5% child poverty compared to over 20% here. So, you know, it doesn't take a great deal of examination to consider why their attainment gaps are not as marked as ours.
We're just coming into the last 5 minutes or so of tonight's show, and if anybody wants to come in with a final comment or question just before we wrap up, that would be great. You can do that by email or Twitter. You allude to in one, or in fact, you make it very clear in one of your pieces that that managerialism and performativity does exist in Scottish education, and you kind of trace that in part back to managers within schools actually moving away from the bigger trade unions into kind of more specialised organisations for their ilk. Is that the main reason why we've seen maybe splits between those at the chalk face and the managers, and led to performativity, or are there other reasons?
I think there was a move from, well, certainly when I was teaching in the 1980s, there was a very strong move towards an attempt to improve management performance, and it came again from a whole public sector reform that was going on at that time, and the view that the public sector was not managed effectively, and it was waste and poor practice. And so certainly that came in with a stronger commitment to management. What I feel did happen, and I was teaching in Glasgow during the strikes of the 1980s, and what happened at that time was that most head teachers were still members of trade unions, along with staff, the sort of rank and file. And I think government saw that as something that needed to be broken, this kind of collective approach where the whole profession was together. And I think they were quite successful in doing it, and it was mostly done through the financial attractions of higher grade management in schools, that the gradation from starting salary to head teacher salary was stretched considerably, and I think head teachers were drawn away from classroom teachers by that move, and so now we see not so many head teachers involved with rank and file trade unions, if you like, but much more, you know, School Leaders Scotland and so on, as being a very separate group. So I don't see it as having had a huge effect, but I think it is there. I think a lot of the managerialism has faded. I think the hopes that this was going to, again, solve the ills of society and education have long gone. So I don't hear it so much now, although there's still, you know, issues around the importance of head teachers, and I don't doubt that. But I think the idea that head management and latterly leadership was going to have, you know, was the silver bullet, I think that has not proved to be the case.
And I don't know if you're kind of suggesting that the rank and file have kind of stood against these kind of moves, but again, go back. I think it was your chapter in Scottish Education. You were warning that. I think you were issuing a warning to teachers that they need to watch themselves, how they behave as a profession, how they conduct themselves in public, because at the end of the day, as you said, 96% of schools are within local authority control. They're democratically under the control of elected representatives, and that teachers really need to go along with, at least to a great extent, with the kind of political and policy moves.
Yeah, I mean, I've always argued that, and often when student teachers come into universities, that they're not often aware just of how political education is. And what I often say to them, you may not be interested in politics, but politics is extremely interested in you. And I think teachers need to be aware, certainly, of the democratic issues around it in local authority areas. But, you know, I wouldn't see that as a hugely significant issue in terms of their own behaviour or attitudes. But I think you need to be conscious that the teaching profession and how they are employed is by local authorities whose teams are elected by local populations. Not an issue, in fact. I mentioned it earlier. an issue that has been broken in many areas in England, and I know from speaking to a number of people in England during my time there, this was a concern that, if you like, local democratic influence on education had gone because the local authorities no longer had the schools. These were separate academies or free schools, and so that, you know, the local population, the local constituency, don't have the voice that they had at one time.
Would you expect that situation is unlikely to change then? That there's this, maybe you could call it a democratic deficit, is going to exist for a considerable period of time in England?
I think there is a growing concern about that democratic deficit, and I have heard people suggesting that they need some kind of, if you like, regional boards that would have some kind of role in calling academies and free schools to account and having some sort of input. So you're almost talking like them back to local authorities, but by another name. But, you know, I think that is a concern. There is a democratic deficit locally, and, you know, as folk have said, for all the talk of empowering head teachers and of devolving power to schools, in actual fact, Michael Gove has served to suck it much more into the centre, because all of those academies and free schools are now contracted to Whitehall. They have separate individual contracts to Whitehall for providing education. So it's an odd type of centralisation that's come around by the back door.
And just finally, if we're just moving into initial teacher education, Katrina Woods has a final question. She asks, how big a priority is social justice in current ITE programmes that you know of, and is there a difference here compared to south of the border?
I think I'd be very keen on seeing it given a much higher profile. There are, in the GTC standards, there is a firm commitment to social justice, and that a teacher seeking full registration must demonstrate that in their practice. But I think we need to give it much more attention. I think it's very difficult, particularly in the PGDE courses. You've only got 36 weeks, 18 of which are in university, to cover a huge amount of ground, and in all honesty, we can only really touch the surface of the big issues around social justice. I'll be very interested in the future to see how the pupil premium works out in England. This is a sum of money that's paid per head of pupil who has free school meals. Some schools have had quite a significant budget given to them specifically to deal with issues of social justice, the attainment gap, disadvantage. It'll be interesting to see how that works out. I think Scotland could benefit from a similar approach, but it has to be managed properly and targeted at those who most need it. If it's just used generally across a school, then I'm afraid the advantage will do even better and the gap will grow. It really has to be targeted quite explicitly at those who need it most.
Donald, thank you so much for taking time out this evening to appear on EduTalk. It's been absolutely fascinating listening to you speak. And if you're listening to the podcast and you want to share any thoughts, then just feel free to put a comment on the website or get in touch via the usual channels, and we'll be sure to pass them on to Donald. The podcast will be available along with all the other EduTalk shows at edutalk.cc, along with the links that Donald kindly provided and the reflective questions for listeners to consider. So thank you very much again, and continued best wishes in your new post.
Thanks very much for inviting me. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.